We have a motion and a second. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no. Hearing none, that motion passes. Now we'll go on to consent items, and this would be item B, and I just need to make a disclosure. According to the Nevada Ethics Commission, opinion number 19-016A, I'm disclosing that I previously was a student in the Gaming Innovation course at UNLV where I developed a casino game. If that casino game is marketed and sold, I'm required to pay remuneration to UNLV in the form of shared royalties pursuant to a standard contract that all students in the course were required to sign. I received no remuneration from UNLV. I'm disclosing this relationship under NRS Chapter 281A as recommended by the Nevada Ethics Commission. I intend to vote on the matters on the agenda for today's meeting concerning UNLV. If, however, a matter comes before the board that pertains to the Gaming Innovation course, its subject contracts, or in any way affects my casino game or my significant pecuniary interests, including policy revisions relating to intellectual property that could impact my contractual relationship with UNLV, I will be abstaining from the vote on such matters. So I'll be abstaining on the approval of the Intercollegiate Athletics audit update. Do I have a motion for consent item B?
So moved.
Do I have a second? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? And I abstain. On to item three, Thomas and Mack Center, UNLV. I'll read my disclosure one more time here, just so we have it on the record. In accordance with Nevada Commission on Ethics, opinion number 19-106A, as previously mentioned at this meeting, I'm again disclosing that I have a pre-existing relationship with UNLV arising out of my involvement in UNLV's Gaming Innovation course and my continuing contractual relationships with UNLV, under which I may be required to pay royalties to UNLV on a casino game that I developed. As this agenda item will not affect my significant pecuniary interests associated with UNLV's Gaming Innovation course and its subject contracts, and associated policy changes, contract interpretation, collection matters, or litigation issues, in accordance with NRS Chapter 281A, I will be abstaining from voting on this matter. So we'll go on to item number three. Joe, please.
Thank you, Chair Carter. For the record, Joe Summer, Chief Internal Auditor. In the audit summary document, I've included a table of the three reports being presented today, along with our key observations. As background and a reminder for the newer committee members, earlier in the consent agenda, you noticed we had an UNLV Intercollegiate Athletics audit. This Thomas and Mack audit covers a similar period, and at the suggestion of the Senior VP for Business Affairs and CFO at UNLV, we were able to gain some economies of scale in this audit as it utilized the same business office, similar personnel, et cetera. I mention that because I think it's a good example of the approach that we try to take with our institutions. While we in internal audit ultimately decide our approach and testing strategies, we want to utilize the expertise at the institution, consider their suggestions as we design our audits. The audit itself had several useful recommendations in the areas of contract management, payroll, as well as enhanced controls in the ticket office and cash handling procedures. Thank you.
Regent DelCarlo.
Thank you, Chair Carter. I just have a question for you, Mr. Sunbury. Okay, you do the audit and the corrective action's been taken. Then how long is it before you go back and see if it's still being complied with? Or is it just go into the next election cycle? I mean, not election, but the next audit cycle. Thank you.
Thank you, Regent DelCarlo. Joe Sunbury, for the record. So our standard follow-up process is 6 months later. That tends to work well. Some of these findings may have a component where it takes a minute to get the policy in place, or it takes a minute to see how the procedure is working. So typically you'll see in our consent agenda items that have gone to the committee 6 months prior. So in this case, athletics went 6 months ago, and now we have our follow-up where the institution essentially says, yep, we did what we said we were going to do, and we have that documented. So thank you.
Any other discussion? Do I have a motion?
So moved.
Regent DelCarlo, and a second by Regent Lieberman. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? And I abstain. Motion passes. On to item number four, purchasing card program GBC. Chief Internal Auditor Sunbury.
Thank you, Chair Carter. For the record, Joe Sunbury. As I've mentioned to the committee before, we're cycling our way through these P-card audits. I think we're becoming more efficient, more sophisticated, and in our next report, you'll see an iteration of our deliverables on that front. For this report, I just want to remind the committee, for these types of audits, we're trying to use, and we talked about this last time, more and more data analytics. That helps us not only efficiently identify transactions to test, but to review items like merchant category codes that are authorized to use on these P-cards. And again, we've talked about this in the committees previously, but it's always good to have that stronger preventative control in place whenever practical. In this case, at GBC, a lot of the recommendations in our transactional testing came back to training. And I think the institution did a great job of identifying those training opportunities and their responses. Additionally, we're recommending some enhancements to some of the review controls that the P-card administrator performs. Thank you.
Discussion? I just want to point out once again, we have, this is on page 2, four occasions where split transactions occurred within the same vendor over 2 days, and that seems to keep on appearing a lot. I've been on the audit committee for well over a year now, and that seems to be something that happens at a lot of our campuses still, so I don't know if there's some sort of memo or something, a reminder we could send out to all of our campuses that there's a limit to your card for a particular reason, and dividing that transaction between two different days is not necessarily the best way to handle that. Do I have a motion to? Sure, please. Regional Carlin.
It's only because I'm new on this committee. So how is that supposed to be handled then if they have a large purchase? Thank you. If they can't do it, I agree to do it split on the card. But how is that supposed to be handled then?
Probably best suited to answer that would be Sonia Seibert, who's heading to the podium.
Good morning. For the record, Sonia Seibert, Great Basin College. For our transactions that were split, a lot of them involved kind of like a fiber, campus fiber upgrade project, which required we had a need for a new switch and materials on one day, and then the next day we found out we needed the same items. So that was kind of a project related. But for larger purchases, we do have $2,000 is our per transaction P-card transaction limit. And then our vice president assistants on their P-cards, they can go up to $5,000 per transaction. So the larger purchases should be handled at the higher level of authority. And then we also have requisitions for just normal purchase order and requisition process for things that are over $2,000.
Any further discussion? Regent DelCarlo.
This question is for Mr. Sunbury. Just wondered, how often do we look at the approval levels for the dollar amounts for the various people? Because, you know, inflation hits everything, and, you know, want to make sure that we got the right levels for people.
Sure. Joe Sunbury, for the record. So in our next audit report, we actually touch on just that subject. And so I think as we cycled through some of these P-cards and thought about what's important to the committee and what's important to our stakeholders, that's something that we pointed out. The nice thing about these P-card audits and utilizing data analytics is that we can get pretty efficient with this, and we can actually do some pretty quick hit and check-ins on these things, get in, get out, and do this kind of behind the scenes. So it's something that we can and should do a little more often, to your point, and we will. Thank you.
Have a motion? Or is there any more discussion? Do you have a motion to accept this report? Regent DelCarlo, second. Regent Lieberman, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion carries. On to number 5, Purchasing Card Program, Nevada State College. Chief Internal Auditor Joseph Sunbury.
Thank you, Chair Carter. For the record, Joe Sunbury. The last of our audit reports being presented today is the NSC purchasing card program. So this committee hasn't necessarily seen the full evolution into some of our deliverables that we've had, but over time we've attempted to modernize our deliverables. You may recall in the last meeting our six-month exception reports added some graphs and some color and some reformatting, and we provided the committee with essentially the same information but a little more useful and in half the pages. For this report, as we thought about the information that the committee may find interesting, and we had done enough of these P-card audits and received enough feedback that we wanted to do a pilot of sorts. And honestly, all the credit goes to our senior auditor, Daisy Cabanillas. Thank you, Daisy. She really took this and ran with it. And really thanks to Kevin Butler at NSC for working with us on this as well. So in addition to our traditional audit observations and recommendations, this report includes some year-over-year comparisons of total spend, top merchant code spending for P-cards, spending limits on the cards, as we just discussed, year-over-year comparisons of rebates earned. So things that we thought that the committee might find interesting and find useful to do some trend analysis. The last thing I'll mention as I tee this one up, and it's really hard to capture this and quantify it in the report, but it's worth mentioning that a majority of items and observations that we had were from the beginning of our audit period. And as systems and personnel changed and stabilized, we could see that improvement in what we were testing later in the audit period. So it's just whenever we can point out a trend like that to committee, I just always like to put that on the record. So thank you.
Any discussion? Do I have a motion? Do I have a second? Second, Regent Michael. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed. So we'll accept purchasing card program. Nevada State passes. So on to number six, internal audit departmental updates and emerging risks. Chief Internal Auditor Joe Sunbury.
Thank you, Chair Carter. For the record, Joe Sunbury. We introduced this section as a standing item to be able to provide departmental updates and, more importantly, have a placeholder to discuss risk. Very quickly on this one today, really just wanted to provide a follow-up to the committee from the last meeting. So I had mentioned at the last committee meeting, especially for our newer regents, that just before they arrived at the December 2018 special meeting, the board voted to change the administrative reporting duties of my position. And while that position still functionally reports to the chair of the Audit, Compliance, and Title IX Committee, the administrative line of reporting also is now to the Board of Regents, specifically the chair of the board. The catalyst for that change was that the board directed that my position serves as a clearinghouse for matters requiring my investigatory activity and shall report directly to the board. So just wanted to let the committee know that I'll be updating the full board on this tomorrow, but give you a little sneak preview, that we now, as part of that charge, I was to put an incident management system in place. And we now have that system up and running. Essentially, if one goes to NSHE's homepage, nshe.nevada.edu, shortly after you see the picture of 13 beautiful faces, just below that, you'll see a link to report a concern. And so a student, an employee, whomever, who may have a concern, can, with a simple click of a button, is directed to a page giving them several options, a 1-800 number hotline, gives them some direction on how to submit a report. They can do it anonymously if they so choose. And it's just a very nice avenue for which people can report these things. From an administrator perspective, the incident management system is very, very useful because it allows us to not only track and monitor these things, but it kind of slice and dice where are some of these things coming from, and just kind of help provide some of that data in aggregate to you guys when we accumulate a little bit more of it. So it's been a very good experience so far, and like I said, I'll go into details tomorrow with the full board, but wanted to share that with the committee today. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Chief Internal Auditor Sunbury? Seeing none, we'll go on to item number seven, Compliance Department Updates. Director of Compliance, Misty Galicia.
Good morning, Misty Galicia. NSHE System of Compliance Director. I'm enthusiastic to meet with you today and to bring you up to date on all the things that are happening in the world of compliance I'm probably the most enthusiastic person in the room on that topic, but that's okay, right? Because you want the charge led by somebody who is enthusiastic on the topic. And just a sneak preview in response to this committee's request, and particularly Regent Carter's invitation, we have a guest from UNR in the world of compliance as well, as far as Title IX goes. So we're looking forward to your presentation. Let me just give an overview kind of where I've been spending my time, and then I'll give you kind of a glance forward to what I anticipate in the coming months. So currently in my office, I'm still working with a... I'm still working with the work group in response to the OCR complaint that was received at the system office. And in that regard, we continue to review at the system level barriers to accessibility. And we have in place, we've implemented an audit tool to evaluate our web content at the system level to understand whether we need to make revisions so that we are more accessible friendly. In addition to that, we have implemented training, and we continue to meet on a consistent basis. And in December, I will be reporting our efforts back to the Office of Civil Rights. So that is an ongoing work group that I participate on, and I will be preparing the report in December for submission to the OCR. I should note that that what I'm discussing right now is really specifically a system office function. And the campuses, of course, have the same obligation and also have had some opportunity to interface with OCR on their own. And as always, I try to provide a resource as well as I try to be responsive but also proactive. So this is certainly an area that I can continue to work with the campuses on to make sure that they are also being responsive. Along those lines, UNLV actually reached out to me and wanted to open up the conversation about the ENSHE policy on accessibility. And so Regent Lieberman has graciously agreed to meet so that we can open the conversation about the system-wide policy. And that's the policy that kind of requires all of the institutions themselves to adopt policies. So Regent Lieberman, looking forward to that conversation as well. Moving on to the sort of the medical world compliance issues, I'm engaged with the School of Dental Medicine at UNLV. They have an interesting landscape right now, as you all, I'm sure, know that there's a transition in terms of the dean of the dental school. But there's also a new-ish compliance officer on campus and compliance paradigm. So the way the dental school has in managing its healthcare compliance obligations is through both the compliance program officer, a compliance and integrity committee, a quality officer, and then a compliance and integrity department. So my goal is to help them facilitate the type of interaction and discussions and open communication and problem solving in a collaborative manner. And you can understand that that can sometimes be challenging when you have different components that need to work together to achieve the same goal. So I'm engaged with them in that level. In addition, we are working on some issues that have arisen around some credentialing and billing processes. The dental school is working on those, and they're also looking at HIPAA in the research space. So that's my dental school involvement at the moment. I also want to bring to your attention that we recently, I met with the Board of Business Officers, excuse me, and also Regent Carter was involved in these discussions. The question being, how are we going to fund the compliance department? So for those of you who have been around for a little while, the function of having compliance at the ENSHE level to provide an extra layer of oversight and resource is a fairly new structure. And so initially when it was decided that the charter would be accepted and developed and adopted, everybody wanted to know how we're going to pay for it, understandably. And so recently that discussion arose again, and I met with the business officers, and we actually discussed a few different alternatives of how it is that we could allocate the cost that the cost of this compliance function. So we could have done so on a volume basis. We could have done so on an activity base. We could have done so more like an equal distribution model. So, for example, a volume-based allocation would be like when you get in the taxi cab and they turn the meter on, right? The longer you're in the cab, the bigger your fare is, right? I regard that as kind of the volume-based model. An activity-based allocation would be more like an analysis of what types of activities are higher risk or require more compliance attention. And then the third one would just be math, right? You add up how many institutions we have, and then you divide the cost by all of those institutions. So I really appreciated the input from all of the people that engaged in this discussion with me. My biggest concern was going with a volume-based allocation because I did not want to chill the process whereby institutions were unwilling or reluctant to reach out to this resource because they were concerned that it would cost them more to do so. I don't think that's a best practice in the area of compliance, and I wasn't in favor of that model. What we chose to do was we chose a combination of activity-based allocation and equal distribution models. So at the end of the day, we counted all the institutions, including the system office. We also counted, another unit of value for healthcare compliance, and then we divided the cost by all of those. Therefore, UNLV will pay their allocation based on the fact that they have a dental school and a medical school and that they are an institution. UNR will pay its allocation based on the fact that it has a medical school as well as the institutional needs. And then all of the institutions and the system office will pay based on that. So there's kind of, I guess you might say, a surcharge for those institutions based on the activity-based allocation. Do you think that describes it, Regent Carter?
Yes. Kind of
the process at the end of the day. So that was what the way that analysis ended, and it didn't appear, and I felt like there was good consensus that was the way to proceed. Okay, I'd like to talk about what's on the horizon, unless there are any questions before I do that. All right, looking ahead, the campuses have been very responsive to my instruction with respect to their compliance inventories. I expect that the campuses are kind of on schedule to get those inventories back to my office by July 10, which will give me the opportunity to report back to this committee. Kudos to UNR. They've already given me their inventory completed. I appreciate it. Thank you. Although I will have to also say I met with them earlier than some of the other campuses. But as I said, I felt like the campuses have been responsive, and I appreciated their collaboration on that. I'm also going to be presenting the NSHE Compliance Department annual work plan at the next meeting. So I'm working on that currently, and we have that to look forward to. And then another project that may take a couple of meetings to cycle through is a fairly significant project. Because we are a hybrid entity it's called a hybrid covered entity under HIPAA, each of our institutions have to identify their healthcare activities and any of the departments that interface with their healthcare activities so that we can call them out and identify those. I'm going to be reaching out to the campuses to confirm that those lists that we have are still accurate or to update them. And then the result may be revisions to the handbook or to the procedures and guidelines manuals or to both. So when at future meetings, when I talk about that, the context is that we're required to identify those components within our system and then memorialize them in our policies and procedures. Thank you, Regent Carter.
Thank you. Any questions? No? Seeing none, we'll go on to item 8, Title 8, Compliant Process UNR. So Regent Hayes and I are both were interested. We've obviously looked at the manual and can see what the policy is in print. But we want to hear from people that have had to live through the policy to see if there's additional changes or improvements that need to be made and how the process is working and how it functionally operates right now. You may have to turn that on. It should be.
There we go. Sorry about that. Aloha. I'm Maria DeSepari. I'm the Director of Equal Opportunity and Title IX here at UNR. We prepared a few slides for you, but of course, if you have questions in particular, I'm happy to start with those to make sure that we've addressed your concerns. Do I have a clicker? Okay, so seeing no questions, we'll go ahead and kind of go through a few slides. I also always like to start, because of the types of issues that come up in our talks, to just say that, you know, it's rated M for mature, because we can get some questions that can be triggering, especially if you've experienced or have loved ones who have experienced sexual violence or something along those lines. So please, if you need assistance, reach out. We are available to help you. Because our office covers so much, I like to use this slide to kind of give everyone a picture of what we cover, what we're talking about. A lot of times when we think Title IX, we think exactly that, Title IX. So sexual harassment, sexual assault, stalking, domestic violence, that sort of thing. Of course, our office is equal opportunity in Title IX, so we also deal with allegations of discrimination, and the ENSHE policy covers both the discrimination and sexual harassment. And so we like to kind of break that out so that the students and employees can know exactly what it is we're talking about. Of course, Title IX focuses on that gender, but because we cover both, this kind of highlights all of those categories for you, so you can see race, gender, religion, color, national origin, age, sexual orientation, et cetera. These categories come from not just federal laws. A lot of these are familiar to our campus community because they are from federal law, say national origin. But we also incorporate state law and just some ENSHE policy. So there are some protected categories on our campuses that are not necessarily protected categories under federal law. And so we like to make sure that everyone's aware of that. So we'll see that, especially in issues of sexual identity, gender identity, sexual orientation, and those areas. So we do get a lot of questions than those, and our policy does cover that. Again, this is language actually from our policy. What we found is many in our campus community are not familiar with the language in our policy because it's not well read. That said, I personally read it often. And so, you know, when I was invited up, as someone, the regent mentioned that they were considering whether or not we think we should update. I think our policy is something that we should look at least annually, and include some of the things that we're seeing. Because as we're learning, as we see issues and concerns being brought to our attention on campus, our policy is a bit dated in that it doesn't necessarily envision some of the issues and concerns that we're seeing. So I would recommend at least an annual review, and I'm happy to volunteer to be part of that. Happy to get that conversation started. Things here that we like to point out, you know, our policy covers not just our students and employees, but also all of those others in our campus community. So we want to make sure that everybody's kind of safe and taken care of. And so we put that out so that they know. And it expands to our entire campus community because we have, you know, we've kind of expanded outside of our, you know, traditional campus structure, and that our campus community also includes a lot of times local businesses for internships and things of those natures. And so we want to make sure that our students are aware of their protections and their rights, and that while they're in these environments that we're, you know, organizing for them a lot of times, that they know that they can be protected and have a great experience. So I kind of jumped into this topic or this conversation assuming that everybody knows what Title IX is, but we do like to make sure that we're all kind of on the same page. Title IX is the federal law that prohibits discrimination on the basis of sex or gender. And so basically that's it, of course, along with VAWA and some of the other laws that you hear commonly in the news. Those have also included actions or conducts like stalking, sexual violence, domestic violence, those things. So all of that is covered, or shall I say, prohibited under our policy. Here we also talk about our time frames, because that's a common concern. So typically, for students, there's a 180-day, shall we say, statute of limitations. For employees using the Nevada Equal Opportunity Rights, it's 300 days. Okay, and so then, you know, as we kind of get into it, you know, the issue is what to do, because, you know, obviously if everyone kind of read the policy and followed it, we wouldn't be here having this discussion. Unfortunately, that doesn't happen, maybe because nobody's read the policy. I don't know. But, you know, once it does happen, something does happen, we want people to know what to do in those situations. And so that is, we encourage reporting. But in addition to encouraging reporting, we want to give people tools. I think it's important that everyone kind of has a tool that they can use in those situations. Because oftentimes, you know, it may be an offensive comment or something along those lines. And so it is okay. And we tell our students, it's okay to say, you know what, this is inappropriate. I don't like that comment. Please don't say that or don't do that. You know, you make me uncomfortable when you put your hand on me or something along those lines. And our policy envisions that and actually says that the person has the right to say, you know, stop. It's not required, obviously, but it is their right. And so we do encourage our community to use that because it's a tool. And a lot of times what we'll find is when this conduct is happening, sometimes it's inadvertent. People don't even realize whenever they talk to someone, they'll just kind of drape their arm around the person's shoulder, not realizing that they're making that person uncomfortable. So if the person turns and says, you know what, that really makes me uncomfortable, they'll stop. And guess what? No investigation needed. Action avoided. We're done. They restrain their behavior. And so we encourage that. Of course, the other side of that, if someone does tell you to stop, you do, under our policy, you are required to stop that conduct. And so it makes it a lot easier if later the conduct doesn't stop. We know, well, you can't say, well, I didn't know, because obviously you've been put on notice because a person told you. As we stated, that's not required, but we do kind of teach these skills to at least give them something so people just don't feel helpless, like all of their rights are taken away, and all I can do is tell somebody and hope that they're going to do the right thing. So, of course, if, you know, the person doesn't, that they tell the stop or whatever, doesn't stop, or if they don't feel comfortable to, they don't have to tell that person to stop. So what happens at that point is they can initiate a complaint. That's done in a variety of ways. Of course, you can go to the website and go to our site. There's actually submit a report or a complaint on there, and you can kind of click through, and it'll walk you through. But that said, under our policy, of course, a person, a student or employee or anyone can go to a supervisor or a department chair, dean, or any of those people. And so we get complaints from various ways. It may be a person going online, and we do have an anonymous system, so they can actually file a complaint online anonymously. It may be somebody walking in our office or calling, or it could be someone went to a professor or an RA even and said, this happened to me. What can I do? What are my rights? All of those under our policy should funnel their way back to the Title IX office. And at that point, we reach out, and we actually have on staff a case manager. And so if we know, if someone reports to us an incident, even if it's not about them, it's a student in my class mentioned this or something along those lines, we have our case manager reach out to that individual so that we can then get resources started. And that's something else that you know, under our policy, all parties are entitled to interim measures and resources. And so there are a number of resources that we offer that we assist with. So it could be something like a no-contact directive so that we're ensuring that these individuals aren't running into each other, shall we say. Or it could be something more like we have this class together and we need to restructure classes or scheduling or something along those lines. So there are lots of things that can be done, and these things are done not just with students but also with employees. So it really is a case-by-case scenario. We change based on what the scenario calls for. That said, if we initiate an investigation, some of the things that we see here on the slide actually come into play as far as the time frames we talked about, but also that here it talks about the preponderance of evidence standard. And so that's the standard we utilize in all of our cases. So we would gather evidence and then weigh it using that standard. This, and I don't know how well this shows on the slide. I apologize for that. I guess we could have made that a little bigger. But this is kind of a little flow chart that kind of shows the flow of things as they come in, the actual investigatory process. And I'm going to cheat and look at this one because I can't read that far. But here you see the initial report. So that's that first one. Most commonly, that initial report either comes from a third party contacting our office or a person going online. That said, we do get them from other ways, but typically that's most common. And then what we do at that point is we in our office do a preliminary inquiry. So we're looking for, whether or not we have jurisdiction. And by that, are these parties, are they a student or employees, or did it happen on our campus? Is it something that, assuming all the facts are true, it would be a violation of the policy? Because too often than not, it isn't. Even if everything they said is true, it's just not a violation of this policy. And so at that point, then it would not be a case in our office. It would be referred if it's an HR matter or something along those lines. But so we do that jurisdictional analysis. We look at timeliness. And then if it's appropriate, we would assign the case. And at that point, we're then reaching out to the parties. And so that's either, that's the the complainant and then responding party. It just kind of depends. That kind of really varies depending on the case. Again, we'd have that case manager reach out to anyone who may be impacted so that we can put resources in place. And then from there, we do meetings, initial meeting, kind of gather that information, interim measures as shown there, and then we can do an investigation or not. As you may or may not know, under our policy, the complainant, so the individual or victim, as someone might call them, kind of drives the train under most circumstances. And so they can decide they don't want an investigation. They just want that department to have training or something along those lines. Or they just want resources. I want help for myself, but I don't want anybody to know about this. And so under our policy, that is their option. And then we would comply with that, absent, of course, some extenuating circumstances, if campus safety issue or something along those lines. And so that's why you see the two little routes, because we could go to investigation, which would then follow with the interviews and the findings and recommendation and that sort of thing. Or it could be nothing as far as that goes, as far as investigatory. It could be all resource-driven or some other non-punitive type of action. Any questions about that? Yes?
Thank you, Maria. I just have a question. Do you keep any qualitative, quantitative data showing how many complaints per academic year you get, how they're broken down based on the population, and to see if there are trends or problems and where we measure for continuous improvement or anything like that?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
We do keep some data. We don't necessarily we do trend analysis as it's coming in. 1 week, if we have 30 complaints in 1 week, we're like, what is going on? What happened that week? Is there something that we can match up? Are these all students? Or is there some kind of? And so we do trend analysis periodically. That said, we keep data on the type of cases. So not necessarily, we have this many student cases, but we have this many alleged age discrimination cases. We have this many alleged sexual assaults, that sort of thing. And so we do that. We actually gather data weekly and then compile it. And then so we could have, we do have our stats to see approximately how many of these cases we had last year, for example. That said, keep in mind, we offer resources and reporting and all of this stuff for everyone. So a lot of times what we'll see, especially with our sexual assault numbers, is that we're getting people who are triggered by something now that on a sexual assault that may have happened 3 years before they came to college. What will happen is, oh, they'll see the individual who, you know, they felt sexually assaulted them. And, you know, both students end up here for college. And so they can be triggered, they can come in. And so so our numbers aren't necessarily things that happen on our campus, but things that impacted our campus community. You're welcome. I thought I saw another hand over there. Did you have a question also? Nope. Okay. I will breeze through the end of this. We do, of course, offer, as I mentioned, interim measures, but we have a couple things in place. We have a campus victim advocate, or as we're now transitioning a bit to a campus victim advocate program. Traditionally, we've had one individual on campus that everyone kind of knew and identified as our campus victim advocate. We still have that individual, but because what we've seen is a lot of turnover, we do that in a partnership with a local community organization, and we've seen that they've had a lot of turnover there. So now we're doing more to kind of market it, for lack of a better word, as a campus community, a victim advocate program. That way, even if we don't have that individual that the campus has kind of gotten to know here available on campus, they pick up and they send someone to fill in. So if that person, even if that person's on vacation for 2 weeks, we still have someone available via that program. So it's really working out for us. And again, that's in community, in partnership through an MOA with a community organization. And so these are some of the other resources available that we work with local on campus as well as off. And we make those resources available and known to all parties. Of course, We never like to end without giving, again, those tools, the things that people can do. What we found the biggest impact, as much training as we do, all of the things that we try and the information we put out, is to give people tools and things that they can do. A lot of times, you know, all of these incidents that we hear so much about on the news are not necessarily happening in our classrooms. Our classrooms are fairly safe, I like to think. But they're happening at the parties on Friday nights and those sort of things. And I have, you know, offered to go to the party with them. Nobody invites me. And what I found, though, is what we can do is kind of arm the other people, the people who do get the invitations to the party. And so we've been really active in putting out bystander intervention methods and giving them tools on what they can do. If you see this, you know, if you see this, you should do this. And oftentimes I'll do that by saying, how many of you, if you saw somebody have been drinking too much, would let them go and drive? And they'll be like, oh, no, if I see them, you know, walking unevenly, or they're kind of slurring their speech, there's no way I'm going to let them drive. I'm going to stop them. I'm going to take the keys. I'm like, oh, well, how many of you, if you saw that same person going upstairs to a bedroom with someone, would stop them? And then they look at me and I'm like, well, why would we do that? It's the same thing, you know, and then we go into consent and those type of things. But by giving them tools and things to look for, then we're finding that more people are getting involved. And our last survey actually showed that. We did a survey in the fall of 2018 that showed that I think it was 90% of them said, yes, I would intervene, and they use these techniques. So we're seeing that it is being effective. So with that, subject to your questions, that's all I have.
Any questions? Regent DeCarlo.
Yes. Okay, thank you. This is very informative, and I thought I knew all the different classes. I've never heard of genetic information on discrimination.
Yes.
So, and I see it's one of the 12 protected classes at UNR. So how does someone discriminate on that? Because if you have genetic makeup, you're
yes.
the only one that really knows your genetic makeup, unless you're putting in the color on that.
Okay. So well, actually, that's...
Explain.
I'm sorry. That is one that is listed under the entry policy. So it's not just at UNR, it's across all of our campuses. Typically where you'd see that is, let's say we just hired you, we offered you a job. Okay, you're going to come and you're going to work on UNR. We just want you to go and have these blood tests taken first. And the blood test may show us that you carry a trait for sickle cell. and we're thinking, oh, that's going to make our insurance go way up. We don't want that. That would be discrimination on the basis of. So now, and it's on the basis of genetic information. So we don't see, fortunately, we do really well with this one. We don't see a lot of that. We don't have a lot of allegations with that. There are some areas where we struggle a little more, or at least, you know, have more concerns.
Thank you. I just, that's good information to know. I didn't know it about this one at all.
Yes.
Any other questions? So in your time here, has the policy been updated? Do you recall?
It has not. The policy has not been updated in the last couple of years.
Okay.
So it's definitely due for an update. And again, I volunteer. I will gladly work with whomever, everyone. Let's do it.
Now, there's currently a Title IX policy update at the federal level. Is that, and that's been delayed or?
Yes. You exactly remember the discussion we had at the last meeting. On the horizon, we expect some changes to the federal regulations. Those were anticipated to have already been released, and that release date has been pushed out by the federal agency. So I guess that's sort of the decision that needs to be made, right? Clearly, there's going to be an update to our Title IX regulations based on whatever the federal regulation changes are that are adopted. And so without a specific time frame for those, it's hard to know whether waiting to do one change is the efficient way to go, or whether we would want to do an sort of a change now or an analysis now, and then knowing that later we would still have to revisit this issue, you know, as you say, across the campuses, because it doesn't just impact the ENCHI policy and it doesn't just impact UNR or UNLV. It'll be across the board.
If I may, with all due respect, that we've actually discussed that here as well. And, you know, because it was open for public comment, there are over 100,000 comments received. So my guess is it's probably going to take a little while to get through that. We're bleeding now. You know, we can say, okay, we wait, we see that, you know, an ambulance is coming. But in the meantime, we have at least some Band-Aids that we could be applying. I don't think that we're doing the best justice for any of our students or our campus communities, and we work well with a lot of the other ENCHI campuses. When we do our training, we have them all come, so we're all on the same page, and we realize there are some areas that we can make a change now and really make an effective difference. And, you know, if federal law changes and we need to make some more changes, then let's do it. But we want to make sure that we're not only in compliance, but we're doing what's best for our population.
Absolutely. Well, we'll talk offline and figure out the best way to go forward with changing our policy. But thank you so much for the presentation. That was fantastic.
Thank you.
Was there any other questions or discussion? We'll go on to item number 9, new business. Is there any new business? Regent Lieberman.
Sort of a follow-up from the last item. Throughout history, it sometimes bothers me that ADA and services for people with disability is lumped into the previous discussion, which is sort of crisis management. But I would like to look at what kind of feedback we're getting from the campus communities on how we're serving students with disabilities, how we're serving the community with disabilities, and how we can do it better, and what the surveys say, and maybe how we can differentiate it from some of the other more crisis management things like sexual harassment and other things that are involved with Title IX.
Any other new business? Seeing none, we'll go on to public comment. Do we have any public comment in Reno? Seeing none, this meeting is adjourned.